Hello everyone, I'm Nate Truax, and you're listening to the CrocCast Podcast. Hello everyone, welcome to the CrocCast Podcast. I'm your host, Nate. And today I'm joined by Clint Bartley of Metazotics and the Colubrid and Colubroid Radio Podcast. Clint, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, happy to be here, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So you want to give people started off on what it is you do and kind of your career path, how you got into reptiles, and what led you up to this point?
Oh gosh, that's a long story right there in itself, my man. But I'll tell you what, okay. I think for me, it started really like it did for most of us. I was catching snakes, you know, when I was 6 years old, fell in love with reptiles as a whole. And I actually bred my first pair of black rat snakes when I was 11 and have bred some sort of reptile, typically snakes, every year since then. This is actually my 31st year producing captive bred reptiles. And throughout the years, my career path took me to retail. I was a multi-unit manager for 20 years at this point, opening in stores and really working all across the country, based out of Southern Indiana. And in 22, I decided that really didn't want to do that anymore. Not that I love the job, love the people, but I've got three young children and I wanted to spend more time at home. And the reptile, I would say side business was doing very, very well over the years. Had built up some nice traction, and I just thought, you know, I've always wanted to do this full time. I mean, this has been my passion my entire life. I think it's time to kind of jump in with both feet and see if we can do this. And this way I could do what I love every day and put my head on my own pillow every night. So in 22, we made that happen. And we are now in August, we'll celebrate our 2 year anniversary as Metazotics. And I mean, things are going great. I mean, I couldn't be happier.
It's great to hear. So what all do you breed at Metazotics?
Whew.
I
would say, so we do have ball pythons. We've got, you know, several morphs of balls. I'm obviously extremely passionate about colubrids as a whole. Asians, rat snake species really, really tend to get me. But I think we have 300. I think the count recently was somewhere around 390 breeder colubrids. And yeah, and that's Chinese king rats, bamboo rats of, you know, various subspecies, Chinese beauties, blue beauties, Taiwan beauties, Korean rat snakes, Japanese rat snakes, Russian rat snakes, green bush rat snakes, mandarins, and of course there's color mutations, you know, in several of these, Honduran milks, Nelson's milks, all kinds of California kings, Mexican black kings, Mexican night snakes, black rat snakes, all kinds of those. Let's see. I know there's all kinds of things. Gray banded king. It's like I'm walking through the different rooms in my mind right now, trying to remember what all we've got. Gray banded kings, Nablocki, Bayard's rats, Trans-Pecos rats, black milks, rosy boas. I'm sure corn snakes, and there's probably a dozen other things I'm forgetting at this point. And then we do crested geckos, we do bearded dragons. We just kind of keep expanding as well. This year we're hoping to produce some green-keeled lizards. We love those. We're working with them. So it's, you know, really the snakes are always my thing for sure. But when opening the shop, we obviously needed to branch out, make sure that we could help more individuals and really try to feed that passion for everyone. So who knows what else we're going to have breeding by the end of this year and going into next.
Yeah. So what in particular drew you to colubrids, and especially Asian colubrids?
So my very first snake, it was a Eastern black king snake I caught. I had it for less than 24 hours. Because at 6 years old, I was holding it outside. It bit me. I screamed. I tossed it. And then I started crying because I couldn't find it. So after that, I ended up catching a black rat snake and kept that for quite some time. And I still to this day love finding those in my area, both the kings and the black rats. And I love like all reptiles and I love all snakes. And I just found that over the years, colubrids, there's such a range, there's such a variety, not just in color and look, but in habitat, in care, in disposition, in size, just that variety and personality really drew me in. I mean, I've always said that if you are a colubrid keeper, and I mean that as in multiple species, it makes you a better keeper of any reptile because you start learning nuance. You know, something we talk about on the show a lot is just that nuance. It's not just a keep them at this temperature and this size cage at this humidity and feed them this. It's how you feed them, when you feed them, if you're in, you know, the different tricks to try, learning how not to get bit, you know, by reading the behavior and how to pick them up. And so I think that's really what drew me in. And then when it comes to Asian specifically, there's so much beauty in the various species of like Asian rat snakes without even needing a morph. I mean, it's imagining a Mandarin rat snake. That's what it would look like if you flipped a rock and found it, you know, out in the wild. And that's just insane to me that they're that pretty. Bamboo rat snake, same thing. I mean, just that much color and they're just gorgeous. And, you know, their little personalities, I just dig it, man. I dig it.
Yeah. Even on a Chinese king rat personality, you dig that as well?
That's just, okay, so with them, I love the fact that they always look pissed. You know what I mean? They always look angry, like they're
scowling. They have the eyebrows. At
you. Yeah, exactly. But the thing is it's like, you know, people ask me how often I get bit by them. I don't. And it's, I've learned how to handle them without taking a shot. And even then, like I've got about a third of my king rats won't even act like they're going to bite you. I mean, you know, they don't sit still and they don't like you, you know, they don't want to be held. But they, you know, they're not aggressive at all. Then I've got about a third of them that, you know, just, you would want to keep your eye on them. And then there's a third of them that they just look at you, daring you to open the cage, you know? And so, but to me, it's, they're beautiful. They're big, they're strong. And it's just another, it just brings more appreciation out, you know, from me to them. And you know, once you learn their nuance, learn their behavior, their demeanors, they're something else that's not too difficult to work with either, to be honest.
Yeah. So is there any particular species that you want to work with in the future that you haven't had a chance to work with?
Oh, gosh. There's, you know, I look and I see different, and probably a lot of Asian species, really, that I see that I don't even know how well they do in captivity yet. Half of them I don't even know the names of. You know, I would recognize pictures of. But I'll tell you the things that I think I'm going to work with real soon. One, I'll probably get into rhinos this year. Everyone thinks I have rhinos, but I never have, and I should. But just, you know, haven't ever pulled the trigger on them. Some Boega. I was already in conversations about picking up, and that's because in Indiana, rear fang venomous, there's a white list, so to speak, you know, where these are some you can have. And so false, as soon as I got a hold of this false, or I'm sorry, this this white list, you know, hog nose are on it, and I was pretty sure they were going to be okay. But when you're opening a brick and mortar shop, you have to know. It's got to be, I want it. I've got a printed email from DNR saying I can have them, you know. Yeah. So grabbed hog nose because everybody was wanting them, but false water cobras were at the top of the list. So reached out to Zach immediately, Zach Lohman, and got falsies in. And there's some Boega, you know, on there. So I've been talking to Dan Sheehan and was like, man, I'm ready. You know, let's do this. And so this year I think I'll have some Boegas. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah. 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 So like in Ohio where I'm at, it just lists off Viperidae, Elapidae, Astracodidae, whatever those evil little mole snakes are. Mm-hmm. And like boom snakes and twig snakes, that's like the only venomous you can't keep. All the rear fangs are pretty much legal here. So
nice.
I do have a falsy, but that's about it in terms of rear fangs.
Gotcha. Yeah, they're neat. I mean, this was my first year getting to play with them and you know, just kind of showing individuals where a lot of times they're huffy and puffy when getting them out of the cage. But if you take a little bit of time once they're out, as long as you stay calm and they're not hungry, then you're good.
Big if.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. So are there any non-snake herps you want to get into? It's like some sort of lizards or tortoises.
Absolutely. What we do, so like right now we do have we've got, let's see, Herman's tortoises, Russians, and we always have baby tortoises, you know, that we get in from other breeders. But our Hermans, we may breed them. Well, they've been breeding, so we may end up crossing fingers, having some luck, and that would be my first tortoise ever, you know, that we would have produced if everything goes as planned. I don't know if it'll be this year because really it all comes down to caging and making sure that we have the right setup, the right display, because this would be a display animal more so than it would be a breeder. I say that, but everything, if we keep something, I kind of want to breed it. It's just, you know, let's see what we can do. Yeah. But green tree monitors are really, really, we've got Ackies here, but I want, you know, something a little bigger, but not crazy. And I mean, I think they're beautiful. And I think that people in the area would really enjoy getting to walk in and see these in a nice big display. So that interests me, you know, quite a bit. And there may be a couple other, you know, medium-sized monitors that we would look into. The thing that's really stopped me from pulling the trigger too much on a lot of the lizard species is so my business has a kind of a three-prong approach. We have the shop, which is, you know, walk in and get what you want. So that's a local market is what I would call that. We have our online presence and we have regional shows. And for me, it's identifying what is really popular at those three different venues, because while I'm still always going to work with what I want to work with and what I enjoy, obviously, as a business, I have to ensure that we're taking care of what the customers are looking for and what they're after. And with things like, I've got a knobtail gecko in the shop right now. I think they're awesome. Love them. I don't think it's going to sell in the shop. And the reason I say it is because it's not popular here locally, not yet anyway. And then when it comes to like online, I'd have to be a little more known for them for it to really move, you know, at a rapid pace. And then at a show, I'm kind of a believer of if I walk by a table and I see someone has one of this, one
and one of that, yeah.
I'm not as confident and comfortable in it. You know what I mean?
And yeah, so that always sends off a little alarm bell in my head when I see those tables.
Yeah. And so that's why, you know, I try not to be that table. Now, I mean, it's this particular knobtail. I mean, it came from Extreme Exotics, Tim Richardson. I mean, he produced himself. He's a fantastic breeder. He's got fantastic animals. I love having those types of friendships because, like, Tim doesn't breed as many snakes, but he breeds a lot of like Australian species lizards and frillies and things like that. And so I help him with snakes. I send him snakes for his store. He sends me cool Australian stuff, you know, for my store. And that works great. But that's why I really haven't moved into some of those things, because I feel that if I'm going to put them on a table, I have to have a presence, you know, with them to show, you know, I'm legitimate in what I'm talking about. I didn't just buy this from someone a week ago and now it's on my table for resale kind of thing. And that's the vibe I think that those one-off animals all over the place give. So there, I will say this is probably the first year that I may start taking bearded dragons to shows. And I know that that's, you know, a very common species, but it's one of the most popular ones in my store. Now, a big part of that is we've got a big, beautiful red dragon named Sriracha. He's out on display. Everyone loves him. So his babies are incredibly popular. But I think we'll be producing enough this year that it's like, okay, now it makes sense to have a table with bearded dragons on it because of the presence that we'll be able to bring in. Bit by bit, we'll continue to grow, you know, what lizard species we're working with. But it comes to space. It comes to knowledge as well. You know what I mean? So it's, I don't want to jump in and buy 20 of a species I've never worked with. I need to, you know, get enough that we can tell a difference from one animal to another in its behavior, but not so many that I'm doing poorly and not giving them the proper care because I've not learned it yet. So.
Well, speaking of shows, I actually just finished listening to your 50th episode earlier today. So Kluberfest, I know you probably don't have much you can talk about at the moment, but do you want to talk about it a little bit?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'll tell you what, it's probably been the most popular subject that I've talked about in recent weeks. I was just at Tinley, you know, this past weekend, and that was absolutely, you know, almost everyone who walked up to the table. So what can you tell me about Kluberfest? Can you tell me where it's going to be? Can you tell me where it's going to be? You know, that kind of thing.
I might ask that after I start recording. But.
So here's what I can say. We have partnered with the Show Me Reptile Show, Mickey Meyer. And that's because what we went into this, Zach and I, we went into this with the idea of, we want to make this something relevant. We want to make this something special. And I think I ran with it a lot faster and harder than what Zach was prepared or thinking of. You know, Zach kind of had a barbecue mentality on it, you know, that we were going to have, you know, people come together like that. And
okay,
and
like the first Crockfest then. Yeah.
There you go. And my thought is, I want that. You know, don't get me wrong. I want that essence, if that makes sense. But I want to make this a much bigger, broader appealed event and something that we can do a lot of good from. And so what we're doing is, you know, I partnered with Mickey because I also knew that's out of my wheelhouse, you know, with what we're about to do, planning an event like this, especially with the things that I was wanting it to include, we were going to need help. And it's funny because Mickey reached out to me before I ever got to him. And, you know, he starts saying, you know, here's some ideas for you, things to how you can do this. And I'm like, no, I don't want ideas, Mickey. I want you to come do it. And I'm in. Because with Mickey, he's done all these shows. I think his exact words to me were, shows have gotten so far away from education. And I want to be a part of something like that again. That's what's going to get me excited, you know. And so he was all in very quickly. And what we've decided is, first, it's going to be a weekend event, okay? The Friday night, everybody who comes in, because it'll be held at a hotel convention center. That's what we're currently targeting. And that Friday night, anybody who comes in will have a mixer. So I feel like that's the barbecue theme, right? That's going to be where it's just people coming in who enjoy these types of animals, can talk, can hang out, can have a drink, have something to eat, and just be, you know what I mean? Just simply be. And then Saturday, we will have lectures, discussions, panel discussions. I'm really looking forward to that. Potential workshops, basically a full day where we're getting to hear from experts on various species, various topics, and conservation efforts. It just, that's where we get to nerd out, right? That's where the education comes from. So far we've hit the barbecue feel and the education, right?
Yeah.
And so then after that day, that evening, we're looking at doing an auction. And this auction, it wouldn't go to US Arc. We love US Arc. We are, you know, we give a lot of money to them every year. But what we wanted was, we didn't necessarily want the auction to be geared towards the hobby. We wanted it to be geared towards a specific colubrid conservation effort. And just thinking about how much a decent shot of money into any effort like that can really give and how far it can go. And we think we know which one, but that's something that's not been locked down yet. So we're still holding on to that one, to that bit of information. But, you know, we're really excited about that, you know, because again, it's being a part of Colubrid and Colubroid Radio. That's what it's about for us, is we want to make positive change and have positive effect, you know, in the entire reptile community, but, you know, specifically into this niche that gets overlooked a lot, right? So that would be Saturday night. And then Sunday would be an all colubrid show. And it would be supplies, it would be feeders, it would be shipping, it would be the other things you see at reptile shows, except when it comes to the reptiles, it would be colubrid only. And the reason that we did want to include a show, and because we didn't want the show or the money aspect of this to interfere with the education, you know, so that's why, one, we're not running them at the same time, because we did not want it to overtake it. However, if we really wanted to be impactful, if we really wanted to have more people in the seats for the auction, if we wanted to be able to raise more money, you know, for that conservation effort, and if we wanted more people to attend even the education piece, we felt like there had to be a little extra, right? There had to be the opportunity to be able to purchase snakes, or for vendors to be able to sell snakes. Or, you know, it's, if you're going to travel to come to this event, if you're going to catch a plane for this,
Make it worthwhile.
And that's it, is we wanted to make sure that we could give as, we wanted to satisfy the whole gamut, you know, that way. And so you could come, you could hang out, you can learn, you know, and get the education on different things, and then still get to go home with three new snakes. You know what I mean? So it's the whole package. That's the vision. And I mean, we're targeting September. As soon as we have the venue locked down, we will make the announcements. There's a relationship in the city that is, and once we have that city locked down, we want to ensure that we get to have the right conversations to make sure that there's, you know, that relationship is kept the way that it needs to be. And that's why we have to continue to hold that, you know, right now. It's not that we want to be secretive. We want to get it out there, but as soon as we have the city, as soon as we have that venue locked in, I know that at least Mickey and I, if Zach's able to make it, he will too, but the two of us will go tour the venue so that we can plan out how it's going to look. Zach is already working on potential speakers and topics, and you know, it's a lot of good stuff, man. I've already got a lot of interest on people who would like to vend Colubrid Fest. And you know, we've talked to some others like Redline Shipping, things like that. So it's coming together a lot faster than what I was anticipating. I was thinking like next year at the earliest, but with Mickey coming on board, I mean, it's really grown legs and started to run. So it's a lot.
Yeah. So switching gears a little bit, do you have any recommendations for people who are looking to get into Asian colubrids? Like, what would be a good starting species, and the basic care requirements and so on and so forth.
Oh, absolutely. I would say, so what I started with is probably the one I recommend for most people looking to start with Asian colubrids, and that is like a cocci. Now, really, you can start with Latocinctus or Poulter as well, maybe even Volante. I struggle with Volante for some reason. But the bamboo rat snake subspecies, you know, any of those three, cocci, Poulter, Latocinctus. Most people really like the cocci. You know, they look good from hatchling until, you know, adulthood without changing. They are very easy to take care of. My hatchlings, I do give a little heat, not anything crazy, but I give them a little bit of back heat, just to about maybe 77, 78. But they can still get away from it very easily. And the reason I do that is my mentality is these animals are hatching during the warmest part of their season. It's not, you know, hot like it gets in the U.S., but being that it is the warmest part, I think it helps them maybe a little bit with digestion to have that option. But my adults, I don't put any heat on whatsoever. They're kept at room temps at about 74, roughly. And they're a small species. You're looking at about 30, 36 inches. So it doesn't take a large, terrarium or tub, whichever you're using. So I just switched this up because they do need humidity. And so cypress mulch is great. It's fine. You can use, Repti chip, things like that. Now, what I have found with cypress is that I don't feel that we get quite, I don't feel that our spot cleaning is as strong in the cypress because it's real easy to miss something in that coloration. And with it being so humid, it also, I mean, I just feel that it's begging for more bacterial growth and, you know, things like that. So we just tried this year. We put our adults on aspen, but we ensure that they have got a cocoa fiber hide that is always kept moist. So they got their humid area, but it's, I think that because a mistake that gets made is another common thing is we sacrifice airflow for humidity, where we want to block off, you know, the ventilation to hold humidity, and then you've got stagnant air. And you'll have this species die from getting spores and, you know, fungal growth on their lungs from things like that. So, you know, I keep them a little more aerated. And now it's like, okay, we'll see if this is going to cause stuck sheds or any other problems by putting them on a drier substrate, but ensuring they still have the humid area that they need. And we're just a couple weeks in on that so far. So we'll see how it goes. But I think it should be fine from everything that, that, you know, working with them. I don't think it's going to be a problem. But if I do start seeing stuck sheds or any other complications, you know, we'll switch back. But I think we should be all right with it.
All right. I'm guessing you'll probably keep people updated through your podcast then.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, we share our successes and failures on that show. So.
Yeah. So moving on from cocci, Poulter, those bamboo rats, what would you say would be the second best and third best Asian rats, Asian colubrids to go for?
I would say second best is probably a Chinese beauty snake because there's a lot of mutations. There's a, you know, they're really pretty even in their natural state. So you've got good looks.
Hence the beauty snake.
Exactly. They don't get overly big like, you know, some of the other beauties do. You're looking kind of, you know, 6-foot-ish. And they're pretty docile. I mean, I can't think of one of my Chinese beauties ever striking at me. With Asian species, most of them are going to be active. So, I mean, they're going to move around when you hold them. But Chinese beauties, I think, are another good one. Care is going to be pretty well. I keep them on aspen without any problems whatsoever. They do get a humid hide, of course, but They don't have any issues with Aspen, and they do well. They breed easy. No heat. Same thing. I don't put any heat on them. So I think that's a good one. I'd also recommend like Russian rat snakes as a strong. I mean, those things, everyone who has them loves them. They're sweethearts. They're super docile. Another one that's real easy to take care of. They start off ugly. You know, that's that. I think that's one thing that throws people off if you don't know what you're looking at.
They look like a darker version of a Great Plains rat snake almost.
Right, right. So they start like that, but then they're going to turn to that black and yellow or black and gold. And you know, so they turn pretty. And they're something that I don't think is super difficult. I mean, I would say
they live in Russia. They have to be tough.
That's right. That's right. They can handle the temperature swings for sure. So, you know, I say that those are probably three of, you know, those, you know, Eastern species that I would say start there. They're going to be the easiest. And if you're someone who doesn't mind a striking snake, there's a lot of them that are going to be easy, but they're going to have attitudes. You know, you get into the Ridley Eye. Love the Ridley Eye, the cave-dwelling rat snakes. They have attitudes. You know, they'll readily strike. A lot of it can be bluff, but they readily strike. But they are beautiful. Same thing, not difficult. They're going to get long. You know, you're looking 7 feet there. The Chinese king rats, like we said, you know, before, they're a bigger, heavier-bodied Asian rat, and they're going to push 8 feet at times. And those, like I said, I think it's more of the roll of the dice on, you know, what you get. Now, if you handle them a lot, they will settle down. Some of my favorites though, man, Blue Beauties, these, you're getting some monsters, you know, you're getting 10 feet plus, and they typically, if you work with them all the time, you're going to get some that are going to be okay. But man, they like to display. They like to, you know, they're going to rattle a tail. They're going to open mouth and hiss at you. And, you know, they will strike readily. But man, it's a blue snake for crying out loud. How cool is that? You know?
Yeah. So, yeah. Speaking of beauty snakes, that reminds me, have you ever seen the movie Bullet Train? I think it's still be on Netflix.
I don't think I have.
That's a fun little action movie, but basically about a bunch of assassins on a bullet train in Japan trying to kill each other.
Got Brad Pitt, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen the previews. I just haven't caught the movie yet.
But one of the assassins uses modified boomslang venom. And so they say, oh, boomslang got stolen from one of the nearby zoos. And they show a picture of it, and it's just a beauty snake.
Yeah.
That's even CGI'd. They even used CGI for the snake, and they didn't even bother doing boomslang. They just did a beauty snake.
You know, I tell you, that's one of the worst things about being someone that's so just into snakes to the degree that we are. Anytime there's one on TV, it's
not even the same color.
No. It's like every dangerous snake's like a ball python or a boa or something. And that's like, so, or, you know, they'll have a snake pit or something. And there's like snakes from, you know, three different continents, you know,
like constrictors and cobras and
rattlesnakes. Yeah, it's ridiculous, but. Yeah, it is what it is, I guess.
Yeah. So switching from Asia to North American, outside of corn snakes and Cali Kings, what do you say are your preferred North American colubrids?
I've always loved Mexican Black Kings. I mean, you know, they're pretty, they're easy, they're kind of bulletproof in a lot of ways. So I dig those. I'll say two things. So the one that has been near and dear to my heart for a long, long time are black rat snakes. And that's, you know, because I grew up catching them, and there's a good wide array of mutations or morphs, you know, with them. That's another heavy body. That's honestly, like, if someone's looking for a North American rat snake as their first snake, I recommend those over corn snakes. Because I think that they're babies, they come out bigger, they're more handleable for someone who's young or who, you know, is inexperienced, because they're not as delicate as a baby corn snake. I think that a black rat snake is probably the hardiest North American snake species that there is. And it's because their range, look at how far, and given we can go talk about taxonomy reclassifications and all that, and that's just going to tick me off when it comes to black rats. But if we just look at, if we lump eastern rats, western rats, and we'll go ahead and put gray rats, let's lump that into one for now, because we can argue what's what. I do think there are a distinct gray rat and black rat difference, and I'll say that. But that range is basically all across North America, you know, and for a species to have that kind of range, they are adaptable and they are hardy. And so that's why I think that that's just a great beginner species for someone. Does get a little bigger, you know, than a corn snake. You're looking at 6 foot, you know, a little bigger sometimes. But I really, really dig them. But I'll tell you, man, as far as what's like what I'm hot on right now, and I think that anybody who's got a bunch of colubrids, that's the most honest statement, because someone will ask you what your favorite is. And I think you may have like that one that, you know, is always going to be there for you, but you get excited about things for a while, and then you may still keep them, but then you get excited about something else, you know. And for me right now, it's gray bands, gray banded kings. And I struggled with those things when I was younger. I mean, but we're talking, you know, 20, 25 years ago, the information wasn't out there like it is now. But now I've got a bunch of breeders, and we hatched out maybe 40-ish last year, and we struggled. We struggled to get them to eat, and I knew we were going to. But once we got our hands on the right scents and really started to get babies going, I really got, you know, hype for these things, because you don't see them that often. You go to shows, and if you're lucky, you see two, you know, and you're always having to ask, what are these eating? Because you don't even know if they're going to be eating pinkies, right? Unscented.
Yeah.
And so now I am stoked for this year, because we've got all the things we need to scent properly to get them, you know, going, and then get them on unscented pinkies. I'm like hype. I'm bring on as many gray band babies as we can, because they're so good looking, you know, and they are, again, a super docile species. They 3 foot, you know, and I love the things that you just don't see all the time. And I don't like to say that I like the obscure stuff. I do, but I don't really target that. I just target things that I think are pretty, I think other people are going to enjoy as well, and that I don't see on 5 tables at any show I walk into. Those are the things that typically get my interest the fastest, because typically if you're not seeing that many of them, there's a reason. Like there's some small level of difficulty to make it happen. And with gray pans, it's getting the babies to eat. So, all right, I'll take the challenge. You know, let's do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, speaking of obscure, what are some species from both Asia and North America that you have worked with or want to work with
that are a little more obscure?
Yeah.
From North America, I would say I've worked with pale milks before. Those are, I mean, very small milk snake species, and I produced a few clutches of those. And I enjoyed them. I liked them. They lay big eggs for such a small snake. And, you know, typically we're looking at like 2 eggs, 3 eggs, you know, in a clutch. So that one just, it got to where I thought, you know, I should probably use this cage space for something else, you know, but I did enjoy it.
What type of environment do they live in the wild?
Well, they're from like Kansas and, you know, that type of area. So they're more of like, if I remember right, like a grassy plains type of species. Again, very, you know, small. You're talking like 20 inches kind of thing.
Okay.
And I think there's going to be, you know, there's different localities are going to look different, but they're pretty. They're super pretty. And let's see. So that was, I think that may have been the most obscure North American that I've worked with. I'm running through my head just to make sure I'm not forgetting anything. I don't think so. I think the most obscure Asian species, and this is probably, if I had to say I had one like feather, you know, or the gem in the cap, so to speak, like the thing I was most proud of. Archilaphe bella chapinensis, bella rat snakes, or chaparat snakes is what they would call them as well. These are stunning. And when I got my hands on them, they had only been produced once in the United States. And I became the second person to produce them in the United States and the first person to produce them twice in the U.S. And really? that had to be the most obscure Asian species that I've worked with, and certainly the most obscure species I've ever had success with.
Okay. Switching gears a little bit. Do you do any herping in your free time?
Oh, free time. I don't even remember what that
is. I know, a rare
is.
Thing.
free time
is the most critically endangered of all species.
Isn't that the truth, man? I'll tell you, I don't get to go out and do it often because I don't get to go out and really do anything often. What I've done, the closest thing to field herping I've got to do anytime recently is behind the shop, there's like a small little drainage ditch, and I've laid 10 along that ditch. And we've got several Eastern black king snakes because there's tons of five line skinks that run around the building. And so I'll flip that 10 and I'll find some Eastern black kings every now and then. So that's cool. I do have 30 acres in Pike County, Indiana, which is about 45 minutes from us. That's where we go. That's our playground. You know, we have a nice lake out there. We go camping out there, just ride our four wheelers, all that. So I do get to do a little bit in that area, and I'll find black rat snakes. I found banded water snakes. I find, black racers, garters. One of the just prettiest checkered garters I've ever seen. You know, out there. So I get a little bit, but I never really get to go somewhere that I'm targeting it anymore. That was one of the things I told Zach on a recent episode that I was super jealous of, is the fact that he gets to spend so much time in the field, you know, looking at this stuff. And it is something that I think once metazotic settles down a little bit, and by settles down, meaning once I have some of the projects that we're targeting completed, it is something I want to do, not just for me, because I certainly enjoy it. I want my sons to get to experience it. They love it. They're out catching toads and frogs all the time, coming in, you know, muddy all over their body. And look at this black rat snake we found down by the creek kind of thing. But I think that there's probably a lot of people like me that would love to do this and just don't get to. And for those that listen to the show, I'd love to be able to tell the stories of, you know, we just went out and here's what happened. Here's what we found. Here's the, you know, the whole funny thing that occurred while it was going, you know, just to get to experience it through storytelling, if they're not getting to get out and do it themselves. So do I get to now? No, but it is something that looks like it's going to be on the horizon for us.
Good to hear that. So switching up to talk about the podcast, what inspired you to do that Morph Market report, you know, other than dunking on ball pythons?
So I'll tell you what, I literally have two passions, you know, and it's obviously reptiles, and it always has been, but I am very passionate about business as well. And by business, I don't mean money. I'm passionate about what people are into, the behaviors that drive individuals to do what they do, and how that relates to, you know, to the numbers. And by numbers, again, it's not necessarily dollars, but understanding this percentage, by this percent being raised, it affects these three other things. And just, I really enjoy that. So profit and loss statements, I'm a nerd when it comes to these numbers. I eat it up because it tells a story of behaviors, is really what it is. And when we continued to do our episodes, and, you know, with Zach and I, we obviously bring two different realms of the hobby and of herpetoculture to the show. He comes from such a strong academic background, and brings a science backing that is just incredible. It's anytime we're talking about Latin names, I'm like, Zach, say it, because I can't, right? But on the other hand, then I bring the market, which not just it's all of the sales, the buying, the selling, the understanding what people are looking for, and really the business side. And we both keep a lot. We both know that piece, so that's what kind of bridges us together. But I figured, I really feel that our listeners and really the audience out there as a whole enjoys both. They want to learn some of the scientific pieces that aren't often shared. And then from the market, here's what's funny. Because I'll be honest, I was nervous to start doing that in the beginning, because there's no way I would have done it within the first few episodes that I became one of the co-hosts. That wouldn't have happened. And the reason is because I needed there to be enough time for our listeners to get to know me, for those that didn't already, and understand that while, yes, I own a reptile business, I'm much more than that. I have loved these animals my entire life, and you can absolutely have a business and still put the animals first, their care first. So once I felt like that was established and people, understood that about me, then it came down to an honest piece. And the honest piece is, in our hobby, a lot of us tend to villainize individuals that do make an income from this. There's a certain group we idolize that make an income from this. And then there's a lot that, they're just in it for the money. That's saying, right? Yeah. They're just in it for the money. But deep down, we all would love to be able to make a living somehow doing this, right? It's because we enjoy.
How much of it is just jealousy?
And we're all guilty of this to some degree, right? So my thought was, if I have established that I'm not just in it for the money, if that's how people, and I certainly hope that's how people view me, because do I need the money to make a living? Yeah, I have a family to support, but I did this because of how much I love doing this every single day. But I do know that there's a lot of us that would like to make a little extra income doing this, and need a little tip and need some, advice, or they do enjoy the market side of it and, understanding what's going on. So I felt like, it's time for someone to openly talk about it and not, treat it like some taboo subject when this is a, multi-billion dollar industry. So there's obviously a market. let's just put it out there and let's talk about it. And I try to give the right balance of facts. Here's what the numbers are saying. Here's my interpretation, and here's just my flat out opinion, of whatever, and here's different things from the experience of doing it, not just in the past couple of years, but I've been selling snakes I guess for over 20, so it's all of that is what I felt that was the balance I could bring. Zach can definitely bring bringing to light new journal articles. And, when we get into some topics where he can explain why a snake does what it does based on its anatomy, I just find that so fascinating. And then, okay, and here's why you're probably not going to sell as many snakes these 2 weeks, but you will these other 2 weeks, just little things like that. Yeah. We both can bring. So that was when it became obvious that was, what we both had. I just kind of tossed it to Zach and I said, man, what do you think about us actually making segments out of this? We did an episode where Zach kind of interviewed me on, let's say you want to do this full time, what does that look like? But it's, I felt like, let's keep that rolling. But I also, I want to know what's new in the world of science every, you know, every other week here. What's popped up that's cool that maybe the average person, unless it got shared on Facebook, you know, 5,000 times, we never heard it or saw it. So, I pitched that to him. He loved it. And I think it's really seemed to have resonated with a lot of our listeners because we do get comments on it, you know, pretty frequently. Every show I'm at, somebody comes up and brings up those segments. Multiple people do. So I hope that it's really, I hope it's doing what we're intending it to and helping people out there.
Yeah. Speaking of the market, I've heard this a few times that people say the market is collapsing. And I've heard other people say, no, it's just returning to like 2019 pre-COVID levels. Interested to hear what your take on that is.
So typically, and this is where I know people think that I look down on a certain segment, and I don't. But the ball python segment of our industry, it's the largest and it's the loudest. And you also have an incredible mix of personalities in that side. You have it on all, but the great thing about the ball python market is it has brought in so much revenue into this hobby, where we have new cages, rack systems, new incubators. There are so many products, and that's just, you know, big things. There's so many products that wouldn't exist if it wasn't for ball python money being dumped into the industry. And that's good. It's also how many people have come into the industry in the first place because of ball pythons. You know, the first snake is a ball python. And so, you know, it brings a lot of people in, and that's good. The thing that the ball python market does that does have a negative effect is a lot of individuals who get into it are getting into it because they think they're going to be able to make a lot of money fast. They get more animals than they can care for in a 2-year period, and they're not yet prepared. You can buy, you know, 40 breeder females in 2 years, but are you prepared for 40 clutches? Are you prepared for those 40 clutches of babies and feeding all them? And then when you realize you don't have the network built up yet to be able to sell all those babies, that's when, you know, you start seeing whole collections up for sale. And there has never been a time that I've gotten a call from our local animal control where they have had to confiscate, you know, reptiles. And it's not been, if there's ever been more than one, it's always a ball python collection. Mm-hmm. And so I say all that, okay, simply to say I'm not bad-mouthing ball pythons. However, that market is flooded. That's there is still demand out there. Don't get me wrong. It's actually the problem is it's the same amount of demand that was there last year and the year before, but there's nearly twice as many animals available. So, you know, that the market's the same, except there's a surplus. And so then once there's a surplus, prices get slashed and they're slashing them, you know, at an incredible rate. And so when you hear the market is collapsing, what it is it's the ball python market course correcting. And another issue with that particular market and why, and this isn't the first time, don't be fooled by that. This is a cycle. It happens. So most other species will gradually come down in price if the price is going to move. Sometimes they'll go up, don't get me wrong, but it's slow and steady if it's moving at all. Ball pythons, they will tend to, the breeders will try to hold the value of a morph or a combo to a certain level far past the time it should be. And so then what happens is this, let's say $1,000 snake gets held at $1,000 for several years. Doesn't mean that's what it's selling for. Don't get me wrong, but that's what everyone sees it's advertised for. And so then you end up with 100,000 people who have 30 of these things that aren't selling at $1,000, and they don't suddenly move it down to 950. It goes from 1,000 to 700 to 450 within a matter of months, and that causes this crash of a certain, you know, more for or whatnot. And that's again, it comes from not letting it naturally cycle down like any other, and I'm going to use the word product, and I don't like saying that with animals, but any other, let's say, commodity would, you know, naturally bring itself down to that level. So because of that, is the ball python market struggling? Absolutely. And is the ball python the biggest segment of the reptile hobby? Single segment? Absolutely. But for any of us that are keeping other things, we tend to be doing okay. And even some of the ball python guys are doing all right as well. I think it boils down to, is what's on your table on everybody else's table? Because if it is, it's probably not going to be moving fast or at a price that you feel comfortable. But if what you have is different, you're probably going to be successful at, and I keep saying shows, but online, in store, wherever, you know, you tend to move your animals. That's what it comes down to, is just be a little different, you know, have something that it doesn't have to be unheard of. It just can't be 3,000 of them at every show.
Yeah. It's interesting to think about those people who get into ball pythons, think it's a get-rich-quick scheme, because that and gold panning are like the only two self-induced get-rich-quick schemes I can think of off the top of my head.
Yeah. And I hate it. And that's, like I said, I think that I then kind of get this, you know, reputation of not liking ball pythons. And they're not my favorite, because they, you know, they just don't have the personality and the quirks that I, you know, the colubrids do, the energy. But I mean, I say, and I've got, I don't know, 140, 150 ball pythons, you know, so, you know, I still keep some, and I still work with them, and I have my favorites, you know, my favorite mutations and whatnot too. It's just, if somebody was looking for any type of financial advice in this hobby, that is not the direction I would tell them to go. It's you're constantly chasing the next morph. Where with like bamboo rat snakes, for example, I don't have to chase anything. I can continue to produce bamboo rats, and they have steadily hovered in the 250 to 350 range for the last 15 years. Yeah. Without, you know, and honestly, that just kind of varies with time of year. You know, I mean, there's sometimes a year where it'll be a little bit lower because everybody has produced what they're going to produce, but then it rises right back up within 2 months whenever that starts going away. So that's I guess what I would say is, no, it is not in peril. It is not going away. The ball python market is going through its cycle. This happens about every 8 years. And it's just going to hit a hell of a lot harder this time, because it's the COVID correction on top of its natural cycle.
So, yeah. Yeah. So, other than the morph market segment, what's your favorite part of doing the podcast?
Oh man, I get to learn. I get to learn so much. I mean, every guest we have on there is an expert on whatever subject we're bringing them on. And what I get so excited about is like I said, we're not just talking about a care sheet information. We're talking about when they say, you know, if you're going to feed them, you have to tap them on this side of the head. You can't put it right in front of them, or they're not going to. Those little types of things that you're never going to get anywhere else, you know, that really help with succeeding with a species. And so to be the platform that gets to bring that type of knowledge out and share that with everyone is fantastic. I mean, so that is super exciting. And the selfish piece, I would say, for me is every time someone walks up to me at a show, or every email that I get that begins with, "Hey, love the podcast." it's such a great feeling to know that what we're trying to do is resonating, you know, with people, and it's helping them. It's making a difference in some way, you know, for them. And it's a positive difference. You know, we're not out there doing things for clicks. You know, we're not, that's not us, is we're doing it the way that we feel is right. And people like it, you know, and that's it, man. That it is a just phenomenal feeling. I never did I think it would be as popular as what it's gotten, you know. It's but here we are. And I mean, I love that it's, I mean, Kluebert Fest is happening, for crying out loud. Yeah. You know, the podcast has made this, it's gotten such positive reception that Exoterra, our first sponsor, they reached out to us to sponsor the show. And that's exciting, you know, because they were fans. They loved what we were doing and wanted to support it and come on board with it. So that's just neat to me, man. You know, it shows that you can succeed. You still can succeed in this world by doing things the right way.
So. Yeah. Yeah. So is there any upcoming subjects or guests that you're particularly excited about? Like any particular species or groups you really want to talk about in the podcast?
So I know that we're going to end up doing a hardcore hognose morph segment, and we're waiting till we have video, you know, to do that. And I think that's going to be really cool. I think people are going to enjoy that one. We have a like a water snake episode that we're looking to do. I think we might even be doing that next week, recording it, or at least aquatic snakes, because Zach, you know, is hardcore into that, and I think that's going to be a fun one. One of the things I'm super excited about is we've started to carve out time now where we are going to record what we're calling CCR shorts. And it's going to be like 30-minute, you know, type episodes that just hit a specific target subject, not necessarily a species, because we want to keep, we don't want to take away from the show, you know, keep the show what it is. But for those who are looking for something more, the CCR shorts are going to be things like an example would be buyer-seller communication. So it would be a 30-minute episode on how to communicate as a buyer and how to communicate as a seller. What things you shouldn't ask or say, what things you should, but here's how maybe to word it. You know, things like negotiating, you know, what's acceptable, what's not. What's the things you need to just let go, or the things that, you know, yeah, that you would have a right to be angry about, kind of thing. So the CCR shorts, once we have enough of those banked, I think we will be ready to then move to having a Patreon for the show. And, you know, I don't know if you saw where we had posted what we're wanting to do with that, but basically it boils down to, you know, Zach and I, we both have full-time jobs, right? We're not looking to make money from the podcast. We love doing it. What we would like to do is there are three targets with any kind of finances from the podcast. The first, we'd like to upgrade our equipment. We need new webcams. We would like to have better mics, better headsets. We also want the ability to go mobile and to be able to do shows remotely. So, you know, we can go to big, we can do a show from Tinley, you know, things like that. We think that, you know, we think that our listeners would enjoy those kinds of things, and it would produce a better show. Number two, we would like to have a travel fund where, for example, Zach and I, we've never been to a California show. You know, that's not really in the cards, you know, to do. But if we were able to do that with funds from the show, go to a California show as CCR and get to meet listeners out there and do a show from a, you know, one of the reptile shows out there, or and go field herping, things like that, and get to show the videos, you know,
record an episode for Roy's reptile room.
Yes. I mean, just, you know, that kind of stuff that I think people would find interesting. That's, you know, we would like to have a fund for that. And then the big one is we would like to start a CCR conservation fund where we get to dictate exactly where those funds go for colubrid conservation efforts. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, it's we want to make positive change. And, you know, it goes further than just knowledge of how to keep snakes. It's, you know, how can we ensure that a lot of these in the wild get to stay there, you know? And that's what we're after. And so I'm excited to not only get to, you know, get the Patreon rolling, but I think that those topical those, you know, little 30-minute shows are going to be fun. I think that those are going to be something that Zach and I are going to be excited to get to do. And that should be pretty cool. I think it's going to be neat. I think hopefully, you know, that our listeners will think so too, and, you know, choose to support us and join a Patreon to help us make, you know, make positive change.
Yeah. All right. Well, can't think of any questions off the top of my head. Is there anything else you want to talk about?
Oh man, I'm good, buddy. I think that, well, how's the snake? I know you just got one from me. So how we doing?
Still slithering.
That's good. That's plus.
Still like slashing onto my thumb whenever I pick it up. So
love it. Good, man. Good. I appreciate it. Yeah, like I said, I hope that, you know, I hope that things just keep moving in the direction that they are for everybody. I think that I continue to see even locally here, because this was definitely a ball python market, you know, in my local area. And I'm seeing more and more colubrids get to pick up. And I think that it's exciting to hear how many people even locally walk into the shop and was like, yeah, I was listening to the last episode. And, you know, that's exciting. And that's it. And anybody who hears this, please, if you're ever at a show I'm at, come up and chat with me. I can talk snakes all day long. You know, if there's really? Ever anything, oh, absolutely, man. And I do talk it all day long. You know, and I think it's, sometimes it's comical to me where someone will email the shop and, you know, ask a question or send something to the Metazotics Facebook page, and they're surprised when it's me answering. And I'm like, hey, I may have a staff, but trust me, we're not, you know, I still clean toilets here. I'm not above anything. So it's, you know, if you reach out to Metazotics, it's rare that I'm not going to be the one, you know, responding. You know, if you're asking about a tarantula, something like that, nope, I'm going to have the, you know, my invert girl take care of that, because she's much better. You know, she's more knowledgeable than I am. And that's what we're going to do, is put the most knowledgeable person, you know, on the line with you. So, but yeah, the whole point of that's just, hey, anybody who, if you got something to talk about with me, man, let's do it. You know, I'm all for it. So,
all right. So where can people find you online?
You can find our website's metazotics.com. You'll be able to find everything we have available right there. You can find us on Facebook at Metazotics, Instagram, Metazotics LLC. You can find me on Facebook, Clint Bartley. And if you are ever anywhere near Southern Indiana, we are in Chandler, Indiana, and I promise it would be worth the stop. It's a good shop.
And also don't forget to check out Clubber and Cluboid Radio.
Please do. Please do. If you don't subscribe and follow us there, please, you know, hit the button, follow us on Facebook, and that way you can stay in touch and know everything there is to know about Colubrid Fest as it draws near.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on.
Hey, I appreciate you having me.
Thank you.